Hello, time travelers, and welcome back to Biblical Time Machine. This is our special Passover edition, our long-awaited Exodus exploration episode. Wow, that was a lot of ease.
Wow, yeah. You're doing well today, Dave.
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. We've had some excitement at our house, but you know what? Everything's fine. And thank you to all of our listeners who have emailed me saying, is this true? Is the Exodus story historical? Is there any connection to Egyptian history? Ellen, I'm going to read some of their names because I think they deserve credit for this episode. So Rochelle Martin, Mark Howard, Menachem Weinstein, Melinda Lubians, Deborah Edgar. These are just some of the people who have, some of our listeners who have emailed and said, please tell us, answer this question. And so we went out and we got Carol Myers back on the program. And what do you think? We just talked to Carol. I mean, I think she had some pretty intriguing and compelling theories as to where this story came from.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounded very credible to me. But I mean, it's just amazing, isn't it, that the archaeologists can go back so far and looking for all this stuff, and some things they find, a lot of things they don't find, and then it's sort of like re-piecing it together with the bits that you have found and sort of telling a slightly different story. So, yeah, really, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, spoiler alert. Archaeologically speaking, there's not a ton we can go by that says these events happened the way that they are portrayed in the Hebrew Bible. But, like you just said, archaeologically speaking, there's other evidence of sort of an alternative origin story for the Israelite people, and these two stories might not be mutually exclusive, and Carol makes some interesting connections between them. So, if you don't remember, if you're not already a super fan of Carol Myers, Carol is the Mary Grace Wilson Professor Emerita of Religious Studies at Duke University, and she published a book back in 2005 called Exodus. It was for the New Cambridge Bible Commentary series, so she has thought very deeply about this, and we really appreciate her coming back on the program. But Helen, before we get to our conversation with Carol, I wanted to remind our listeners about the Time Travelers Club. That's our cute name for the Patreon that we have for our listeners to support the show and what we do. You might notice, listener, that we don't have any ads on our podcast. That's not a mistake. It's really enjoyable. I know when I listen to a podcast and I don't have to fast forward through a bunch of ads for metabolism boosters and online therapists. But what that means for our side is that we are not getting sponsorship money in to make this show. So if you enjoy the show, if you listen to it every week and are excited about the topics that we discuss, we really encourage you to join the Time Travelers Club. Support us through a $5 a month subscription. It makes all the difference. It really allows us to do what we do here. It does take a lot of time to research these topics, find the guests, talk to the guests, record it, edit it, publish it. You know, it does take work, and we love doing it. We want to keep doing it. So if you appreciate what we do, please, you will find the link in the show description for the Time Travelers Club. Head over there, subscribe. You will get access to cool extras. Just the other week, we put up a video of us recording the podcast live at that SBL meeting. You get interviews with guests that we don't publish to the wider world. We get little conversations between Helen and I that are so witty and enjoyable, right? So that's my pitch. Please consider supporting us through the Time Travelers Club. Thank you to all of you who are already doing it. You are our favorite people on Earth. All right, well, let's get to our conversation with Carol Myers about, did the Exodus actually happen? Carol Myers, welcome back to Biblical Time Machine.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here again and to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
Oh, good. It's one of our favorite subjects, too, and it has been long awaited by our listeners. So let's get into what can we figure out about the history of maybe the most famous story in the Hebrew Bible. So let's just get a time frame if we can. If we're trying to place the Passover story in some, you know, ballpark period of history, or ballpark period of Egyptian history in particular, you know, what's our best guess as to when the Exodus might have actually happened?
Well, first of all, I don't like to talk about the Exodus, but we can come back to that problem later. The one historical piece of information we have that we can use to pin this all on is a black granite stele called the Israel Stele, which celebrates the victories of a pharaoh named Merneptah late in his reign, probably around 1203 or 1208 BCE. And this stele glorifies Merneptah's military victory over the Libyans, the Sea Peoples, and it also mentions a prior campaign in Canaan in which he defeated, among others, several city-states, Ashkelon, Gezer, and Yanoah. It also mentions Israel. But the hieroglyphs for those three cities I mentioned include a particular sign denoting a city. And the hieroglyph sign with Israel is typically used for a group of people without a fixed home, implying that they're not a city-state at the time, but there's kind of a group of people. So we have to assume, at least I do, and many, many biblical scholars do, that there is something using the name, some kind of entity using the name of Israel already by 1208 BCE, which means that if there's an Egypt story associated with them, it would have to precede that date. In any case, that's the first extra biblical reference to Israel, and it's a pretty important piece of archaeological material.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. I mean, it's so, and it's amazing to me that you can date it so specifically as like either 1203 or 1208. That's incredible. But like you said,
well, I'm not an Egyptologist. I'm just believing what Egyptologists tell me on the basis of their reading the hieroglyphics.
We're glad other people know how to do it. So, any of these people that are mentioned on this stele, then can they be positively identified as Hebrews?
Well, we run into this problem with a term called apiru, which appears in many Egyptian and other sources, actually. And for a long time, biblical scholars leaped at the possibility that apiru is the equivalent of Hebrews, because it sounds kind of the same. There may be a linguistic explanation. I think that possibility has pretty much been debunked by now, although knowing what we know about the apiru, there is, I suppose, a possibility that some of the early components of what might be called Israel were part of or came from the group of apiru. The apiru were a loosely defined, usually considered inferior social class of shifting elements of the population, and they were found not just in Egypt, but throughout the Fertile Crescent and throughout the second millennium BCE. And the texts in which they're found characterize them variously as outlaws, bandits, mercenaries. Sometimes they were captured and were enslaved, but there's no common ethnic or national affiliation. It's kind of a social class, not a national class. And some of the earliest Israelites may in fact have been these kinds of bandits, but we can only speculate. There's no proof one way or the other.
All right. Well, I know that when people talk about Egyptian history and the Exodus story, a name that gets thrown around a lot is Ramses II. So, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Ramses II, that must have been the pharaoh that they're talking about in this story, the cruel pharaoh. So is there any kind of, is that in the text anywhere? Or is there any other links that we can make that can identify Ramses as this pharaoh or any other pharaoh as this figure?
The only thing that makes Ramses the second fit, and let me tell you, his he ruled from 1292 to 1189 BCE. So his regnal dates fit what I've just described before, the possibilities that the beginnings of Israel in the Levant had to be at least by the time of 1208 BCE. Okay. So he he fits that time frame, but he's not mentioned by name in the Bible. He's not a specific ruler. He's kind of just generic king. And like many people, I believe that his anonymity has a rhetorical function in the story. He kind of represents all oppressors. And at the very least, denying him a name maybe is a way of demeaning him. And I like to contrast this with the two lowly midwives who help with the baby Moses. They each have a name, Shipra and Puah. And by the way, they refuse the Pharaoh's orders to kill Hebrew boy babies. And that makes them arguably the first mention in world literature of civil disobedience. So there's two little recognized themes. The role of women in the beginning of this unfolding drama of liberation, according to the Bible, and civil disobedience, allowing people to multiply and become strong. I mean, these are literary figures, but that's the message that they convey.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess the only thing that some people talk about in the text are these towns, right? They kind of specifically name two Egyptian cities, and I don't know how we Pithom. I don't know if we put Pithom and Ramses. So it has his name, Ramses. But do you have archaeologists found any evidence of cities of this name? And do they relate to Ramses II in any way?
Well, the bottom line is kind of no. The name Pithom is probably derived from the Egyptian word meaning temple of Atum. And there are many temples of Atum, and there's not any one of them that can specifically be identified as being in the right place at the right time.
Okay.
The other one, Ramesses, is a little more complicated. It might be a reference to the capital in the time of the Ramesses pharaohs called P. Ramesses, and it was the capital of Egypt in the 13th and 12th centuries BCE. You know, it would be the right time frame. And its exact location, however, is debated. It may be a site called Bubastis, but that doesn't have any Ramesside remains. It's more likely a site, and most archaeologists would agree with this, called Kontir, which does have 19th dynasty remains and was the largest city in Egypt. It was built as the capital of Egypt during the Ramesside period. However, neither of these cities would be considered a store city. And their mention in Exodus 1, verse 11, is best understood as reflecting the time of the events it narrates, or maybe the time of the narrator. And by the way, it's similarly for virtually all the names of the places they're supposedly on the route of the Exodus. They cannot be identified with any archaeological remains that have been discovered. And even Sinai is in doubt as an historical place, where a dozen or more possibilities have been suggested over the ages. So historical geography does not help us understanding the historical, or if there's an historical background to the narrative of Exodus in the Bible.
I mean, I thought Sinai was one of the bits we could at least depend on, because there's still a Sinai.
The Byzantine Christians, Orthodox Christians, loved having monuments or monasteries or some recognition of important biblical places. And one of the things they did was build a monastery called St. Catherine's at foot of a mountain called Jebel Musa, which means the mountain of Moses. So we have that. The Byzantine Christian monks, I think this goes back to the time of Justinian, they believed that that particular mountain was the Mount Sinai. But there's no way to prove or disprove it. There's certainly no archaeological remains there that would fit anything like what is described in the biblical narrative.
So our listener Menachem asked a question that I think a lot of us have wondered about, and that's the Great Pyramid at Giza. You know, but we all, I think, have this idea that it's built with slave labor, and could they have been Hebrews?
First of all, let's look at the date. The Great Pyramid of Khufu was built in the 26th century BCE. Uh-huh.
Right. I'm seeing so problems already.
That disqualifies it right away. And we really don't know much about where the workers came for building that. We can only presume that it was not a good deal to be a worker on one of those pyramids, that hundreds, if not thousands, of people probably died doing that extraordinary bit of civil engineering.
So when I think of ancient Egyptians, I feel like they were very organized and they would have kept very good records. So do we have any records of the Egyptians saying, yes, we enslaved this large population of people and they were forced laborers and they built this for us? Or, I mean, do we have any evidence of that kind of thing happening in the time period that we're talking about, whether or not these were the Hebrews or somebody else?
Okay, I don't think, and again, I'm not an Egyptologist, I don't know whether there are any records of slaves being brought in per se. But what I will say, and I will probably repeat this later, is that repeatedly there's evidence that foreigners came to Egypt and stayed there. And that would be for various reasons. Some of them were traders from the Levant. The people came to do business in Egypt and they set up little outposts there. There's also the evidence that we have from a group of tablets, cuneiform tablets, that actually were discovered in Egypt at a place called Tel El Amarna. And these tablets they're earlier than the 13th century, they're from the 14th century, but they show the kind of wheeling and dealing being done between the pharaoh of Egypt and the kings of the various city-states, Canaanite city-states, that were in the southern Levant at that time. And the pharaoh of Egypt had hegemony over those city-states, and they were repeatedly had to do things to please the overlord, the pharaoh. And I just remember hearing a professor read the beginning of one of them to me decades ago, and it starts like this. To the pharaoh of Egypt, 7 times 7, I will bow down. Hmm. 7 is a holy Semitic number. 7 times 7 means they're really, really bowing down. And as a way of showing the pharaoh that, don't worry, we're not going to rebel against you, they would send all kinds of gifts. And sometimes these were material objects, but sometimes they were people, dancing girls who pleased the pharaoh, or people who could become servants in the royal household. So we have that kind of information. And there's another kind of information that suggests people from the Levant is the biblical record itself. In the book of Genesis, in the stories of the ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, and so on, what happens when there's a famine in the land? Where do they go? They go to Egypt. Hmm. Now, there were famines recurring in the southern Levant in the biblical period. Drought, famine is a recurrent theme in the Hebrew Bible, so we're pretty sure and archaeology can show years of dryness and famine. And so that's where they went. The Nile Valley was the breadbasket of ancient Egypt. And when peoples in neighboring areas were struggling, some of them would become exiles and go to Egypt as immigrants. But what I would say about them is that the foreigners who went to Egypt usually kind of lost a sense of where they were originally and became assimilated into Egyptian culture. The Egyptians thought foreigners were weird, different. They didn't accept their otherness, but they encouraged them to learn the Egyptian language, stop speaking their original language.
And good thing we don't feel that way now. Good thing so many things have changed.
It's an old story, isn't it?
I would love to try to make any connections, you know, as tenuous as they are between, you know, what we know about, you know, this time in Egyptian history and our story in the Hebrew Bible. So we got to get to Moses. Moses is the hero.
I want to come back to what might have happened later, but sure, we'll talk about Moses.
Okay, well, let's squeeze Moses in and we'll come back. Just because I think I read this in some of your research that, you know, like you said, foreigners would be coming into Egypt for any number of reasons, but there were, you know, maybe there are some records of foreign people kind of being not necessarily captured, but kind of royal houses, like elite houses, people kind of being taken from these other territories back into Egypt, and maybe some children being, like foreign children being raised in the homes of sort of elite Egyptian families. Was that part of it? And then can we make any connections between, you know, Moses's story of being raised in the Pharaoh's household?
I think that's a possibility. Some of these Semitic peoples who came into Egypt or brought into Egypt or sent into Egypt, as I said, some of them became servants or slaves in royal families. And that is a theme that would have been known to whoever, whenever this Egypt story about Moses was composed. There are a lot of things actually in the story that reflect reality of an ancient Egypt. There are a lot of names that are Egyptian names. I mean, Moses' name, according to Exodus 2, Moses' mother brings him, after he's pulled out of the Nile, brings him to the Pharaoh's daughter, and she names him Moshe. And there's this wonderful kind of etymology given in the Bible, saying that name is from a root meaning to draw up. I drew him out of the water. But actually, that doesn't make sense. The biblical writer wants us to know that the name means the one drawn out of the water. But etymologists and linguists tell me it's really an active participle. It would mean the one who draws. And in any case, the one drawn out certainly would yield an Egyptian name. And it's an Egyptian name makes sense because many names have this Mosa component, like Tutmosis and Amenoses and Remoses, which mean child of Ammon or child of Tot or child of Re. So we have Moses, really child of, but without telling us of whom.
Yeah, like, you know, Helen, and we have to do an entire episode about Moses. Obviously, what an incredibly important figure in this history. But yeah, Carol, you know, what more can we figure out about Moses? I know clearly he's this literary figure, but you know, how can we connect him with these movements of people and the scant, you know, archaeological evidence we have from this time?
Well, we'll never have any definitive proof, but I like to try to think about the dynamics that are involved in the stories about him. Just think about his birth story, which we've already alluded to, about being saved in a basket in the Nile and brought up by the Pharaoh's daughter. This is, by the way, not a unique motif or unique story. It's a way in ancient Semitic literature of talking about someone who rises to extraordinary greatness. For example, the king Sargon the Great of Mesopotamia is found in a basket and then gets endowed with special powers by the goddess Ishtar. And he arguably is the one who established the first world empire. There's a similar legend, a birth story being found in a basket about Cyrus the Great, who establishes the vast Persian Empire. So rescue from waters is a literary trope, let's say, of the ancient Semitic world as being a way of saying this guy's going to be important in the future. It's a sign of future greatness. The idea that this is a person who's very special, if not extraordinary, by signifying something extraordinary about his birth. And we have that throughout the Bible. I mean, we have birth stories for people who become important. Isaac, Samuel, Samson, Jesus, of course.
Jesus, yes.
He's got a couple.
Roman emperors, all kinds of people. Yeah, right. Later on, there's all sorts.
So that's one thing that we have to keep in mind about Moses, that this is a literary motif to try to say, important man, exclamation point, underline.
Here's a basket.
There's another thing. If you look about it, he has every kind of possible role that a person can have. He's a teacher. He's a leader. He's a military figure when we get to the Amalekites. He's a diplomat, well, kind of, trying to negotiate with the Pharaoh. He's a lawgiver. according to the Sinai narratives. He's a cultic innovator. He's, even though he's not called a prophet in the book of Exodus, he is eventually called a prophet. And he's a miracle worker along with his brother Aaron. Mm. He's the chief executive. He's the chief justice. And he's also a family man. Mm. Now, what ordinary human being or even extraordinary human being can do all those things? Those multiplicity of roles, the fact that the narrator, and I think this is not recognized often enough, the narrator has woven in so many different roles is a way of saying this is someone of great significance. And when I tell my students about this, I like to compare Moses to George Washington and American history. Mm. The historian William Bryan studied all the biographies about Washington, and he said that if you were to read only the biographies written about Washington before 1855, that is early in the American experiment, that you would think Washington was a demigod who descended to earth, his character already fully developed and flawless, even in childhood. He freed his people from oppression, steered their government for a few years, and returned to heaven. Which is kind of what Moses does at the end of the story, where his birthplace is not, his tomb, his death place is not known.
And there's that famous story about George Washington and the basket. He was born in a basket too. No, he was. He chopped down a tree. Anyway, I got confused. Sorry, keep going. Moses.
So, I mean, these stories are almost certainly, I would have to say, if there wasn't a person named Moses, they would have had to invent him. Because this notion of someone being able to get people out of a bad situation and then put two and two together and think that since things didn't happen without divinity involved, that there was a God that really could do these kinds of things. And there had to have been an important leader in that small group that we've been talking about. And call him Moses if you want, because that gives him an Egyptian pedigree as well as links him to the story, to the storyline of the Exodus.
Hmm. And what about the Midianite connection? Isn't there some evidence in the Torah itself that Moses might have been a Midianite? Certainly there's a connection with his father-in-law, Jethro, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, Moses is not a Midianite.
Right.
But they are, according to the genealogies in Genesis, Midianites are descendants of Abraham along another line. And so, quote unquote, they are related to the Israelites. And the Exodus has them being very helpful. There are two important Midianites in the Exodus narrative. Moses' father-in-law, if you remember his name, Reuel, or Hobab in other tellings. He helps set up a judicial system for the Israelites in the wilderness. And of course, Moses' wife, Zipporah, is a daughter of a Midianite priest.
Yes.
So the Midianites are a group that probably can be recognized from some of the distinctive pottery that's been found in the Negev. They are not all nomads. Midianites is probably an ethnic term, and they become an enemy in later biblical texts. And Midian becomes kind of a geographic term. But one of the most interesting things about them is that there are a couple inscriptions that mention a group of desert dwellers that included Midianites. And this group of desert dwellers was called Shasu, S-H-A-S-U. And one of the inscriptions mentions the Shasu of Yahawah, which is identified by a lot of scholars, and I'm very sympathetic to this reading, as Shasu of Yahweh. That is the idea of Y-H-W-H as the name of the Israelite God in the Bible may be derived from this group of desert dwellers encountered by some people, proto-Israelites, in the Sinai Peninsula. In any case, they were controlled the spice route in the late Bronze Age, in the late 13th and early 12th century, which is the time that we're talking about.
Yeah, is that, I mean, is you, as you mentioned earlier, there's no, you know, archaeologists have struggled to find evidence of any of the place names mentioned when the Israelites are wandering through the wilderness for 40 years. But you say that we have found, you know, distinctive pottery and things related to the Midianites. So does that, I don't know, does that kind of give any further credence to this idea that maybe it was more of a Midianite thing? Like Yahweh was, that was the connection with the Midianites, and maybe Moses came up through that tradition, and that's, and he was sort of, they and their God were sort of adopted later by the Israelites. Is that a theory floating around?
This is how it might be reconstructed. Well, let me back up first. There are a lot of negatives about the Exodus story that we have in the Bible. Mm. First of all, archaeology. There have been extensive surveys in the whole Sinai Peninsula, especially when the modern state of Israel controlled the Sinai Peninsula after the 1967 war. They surveyed the Sinai Peninsula, and the archaeologists have surveyed the eastern delta from whence the Israelites were supposed to have come after leaving Pitom and Ramses. There's no evidence of a movement of a large group, which according to Exodus 12, verse 37, says that 600,000 men plus women plus children, so we're talking about well over a million people, leaving Egypt. That actually probably pushes a quarter of a million people. Palestine itself, the southern Levant, never held that many people at its height. Maybe as not even half a million people. So that's one archaeological piece of, it's negative evidence, but I think it can't be discounted. But there's another kind of archaeological evidence, which was is, I think, important. Excavation at the major oasis in the Sinai Peninsula, which is Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea has a spring that runs year-round. I think it may be the only one, maybe there's another smaller one. And it certainly would be a staging ground for Israelites, according to the biblical story, before they come around into Transjordan and come into the southern Levant. It's been excavated very well, and there's no occupation there until the Iron II period, till the 9th or 8th century, hundreds of years after the Exodus would have happened. Mm. So archaeology, it doesn't help at all. It's all negative evidence. The Egyptian sources, while they do refer occasionally to non-Egyptians coming into or living in Egypt, there's no mention of a group of Hebrews in work camps. Pitom and Ramses are not store cities. There's no mention of a Moses. Now, of course, in fairness, Egyptian sources wouldn't be expected to tell about being outwitted by a foreigner. But if it's just a small group of people, and I'll come back to that, then of course they wouldn't be mentioning it. And then, as we've already been talking about this, the what we call the onomasticon, the names that we find in Egyptian sources and Israelite sources in the Bible, almost none of them can be identified. So that has led a group of scholars that I would call minimalists, some people would call them nihilists, to say that there's no credence at all to the Book of Exodus, the narratives in the Book of Exodus, that it's all invented to shore up Israelite identity or Judean identity at the time of the expulsion of many people by the Babylonians, exile, or even later. However, there is general evidence that the overall storyline of a group of non-Egyptian people who've been working in labor camps, of those people wanting, even though they, many of them became assimilated Egyptians, there apparently sometimes were some who wanted to go back to their homeland, despite efforts of the Egyptians to stop them. And that can be verified because of one or two inscriptions. There is a papyrus letter that has been discovered at a border post that does mention that a small group of people managed to get through the border. So let's think about it. There are three main components to the Exodus story. There's movement into Egypt, as we've talked about already. It happened all the time. People end up in Egypt because of famine, because they're merchants, prisoners of war, whatever. But that happened most frequently at the end of the Late Bronze Age, the 13th century, which is what we're talking about. So that's the most intense period of movement. Then there's a sojourn, a period of time in which these Asiatics live in Egypt. And as you said, sometimes they become high officers in the Pharaoh's household. But more often they work as menial laborers on state projects, even making bricks, as the biblical writer knew about what would happen to these. And then there's the departure. Even though most were absorbed into Egyptian society and had no recourse, but occasionally some apparently fled through border posts. So while Egyptian sources and other sources have no specific mention of the Exodus, there are ample analogs to the biblical story of descent to Egypt, sojourn there, and departure, especially in the 13th century, the end of the Late Bronze Age. So I think that there is a storyline underlying the elaborate gripping narratives of the book of Exodus that is plausible.
So what, a much smaller kind of event, you mean, that's been sort of reflected on later on and sort of built into this sort of powerful national memory, I suppose. So how do you think it became this sort of the big myth, the big story that it is now?
Well, I think you have to go back to the Shasu and their God. And you have to remember that it was really hard to get out of Egypt. They had border posts to try to keep people from fleeing. And so these people, a small group gets out, and as they traversing Sinai, they meet up with these Shasu, and they hear about this God, Yahweh, and they don't necessarily have their own specific religion, but this God seems to be powerful, and they attribute their ability to escape to the miraculous saving powers of this deity. And they bring that deity with them into the southern Levant, and they tell their long-lost cousins, the ones who'd stayed there and hadn't gone down to Egypt, but other Semites who were living, Canaanites probably, who were living in Palestine, about the fact that there was this one God who could do amazing things. And the story spreads. This was a period of great turmoil in the Levant. We have a lot of movement of people around. We have the Sea Peoples, Philistines are one of them, for some reason leaving the Aegean area. The Hittites in Asia Minor are pretty much destroyed. And there's turmoil in general. So this small group comes into the western side of the Jordan River, and they want to settle in. But there are still Canaanite city-states controlling most of it. But there is a place where there are virtually no settlements, and that's in the central hill country. And archaeologically speaking, there's absolutely no doubt about the period of Merneptah, the period after this turmoil and departure from Egypt. There pop up dozens, if not hundreds, of tiny settlements. And they have unique archaeological features, and they become a group of people that kind of celebrate the fact that they are allowed to live on their own land and raise their own crops. They're not, some of them probably left Canaanite city-states in order to live on their own land and not pay heavy taxes and tributes to the surviving kings of the Canaanite city-states. I want to get back to how this kind of takes hold. How are we to understand the narratives in Exodus? And I think it's a mistake to think about them in terms of history or fiction, you know, either they're true or they're false. In antiquity, storytellers would tell details about a past event because they were important, not because they were true. I mean, they were outside the realm of verifiable history. And scholars have a name now that they use for this process. It's called, Mnemo history, or it's really Nemo history, Mnemohistory, as in mnemonic, that is how you remember something. So it's Nemo history is collective cultural memory, not historical record. And so the past gets remembered and recited in ways that meet the needs of people over time. It's not like personal family members. I don't know about your family, but we don't have much memory of our family going back past our grandparents, certainly not many generations before that. But collective memories, not personal families, but collective memories can form around an intense group experience. So this intense group experience of a small group of people miraculously escaping from a foreign land, these group experiences are recalled and ritually remembered, commemorated to serve the identity and the needs of a later community. And they help create the identity of this people, Israel. So let me just say that's an hypothesis as a way of accounting for all the information that we have and don't have. And I don't know whether that can ever be proved, but I think it's a reasonable explanation for the flow of the narrative, which is very dramatic. I mean, first of all, the Israelites are mostly not literate. They're listening to these stories. And the dramatic nature of the narratives are a way of the storytellers kind of involving the listeners into the group of people that is being described in these stories and joining with them, agreeing with them that Moses was a great leader and that these people did experience miraculous escape. And the 10 plagues.
I was going to ask about the plagues. I mean, this is very highly dramatic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, a miracle is a way of saying that something happened that was unbelievable. So it's unbelievable they escaped. So they have literary motifs that show the unbelievable happening as a way of conveying that notion of being rescued or surviving great difficulty and coming out to try to become their own free people in a different place. The important thing to know is that the story is basically a story about freedom. I believe that there were authentic events affecting a small group of people escaping, and that the escape was made possible by a deity that was new to them. And all their subsequent beliefs that we see expressed in the Bible are shaped in reference to this foundational story of escape to freedom, escape from oppression. And it's a story that resounds loud to this very day.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, you mentioned, you know, the archaeological evidence of these settlements in kind of the hill country, pointing to, you know, a later period when maybe this identity was forming of the Israelites. I guess I was interested to hear that this was also around the same time, like you said, of the arrival of the Sea Peoples. I guess I didn't put two and two together when you said 1200 BC. Like, this is getting into that period that they call the Bronze Age collapse, right? So this was a time of like tremendous destabilization in the region. So exactly. We can connect these events to sort of that same time period.
I think we were talking about that a little bit already. Yeah, this is a period of turmoil in the ancient Near East, and there was a lot of movement of peoples, and the Egyptians were trying to hang on to their control over the city-states of Canaan, ultimately unsuccessfully for a while.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I'd never put, I mean, that's again another sort of, you know, historical event that we could point to. So it's really interesting to think that these events are all possibly connected. All right. Well, we are going to get to our final and most important question, which of course is, when you get a chance to use our time machine, Carol, where and when shall we take you?
Well, you think I would want to go back and talk to Moses?
Yeah.
I kind of would. But as a feminist biblical scholar, let's go to Miriam, who hasn't been mentioned in this whole story. I'd like to know a little bit about what she was doing in her time period, how she learned to play the hand drum and sing. And I believe that she's the first recorded prophet in the Hebrew Bible, because the Song of the Sea in Exodus 15 is really should be attributed to her, not to her more famous brother. So I'd like to work that out with her face to face.
Oh, wow. And is that, do scholars think that is one of the oldest sort of pieces, oldest pieces of the Hebrew Bible?
It is the poetry part of the narrative.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Carol. Like we said, we've had many listeners emailing in very curious about, you know, they've probably seen the Ten Commandments a few times. Maybe they've seen the Disney
Prince of Egypt.
And they're like, well, clearly these are historical events. I think we've made it clear.
I was a consultant for that story.
Oh, very cool.
Nice. I mean, for that film. And
you could tell that they had some extra bits and pieces, you know, bits you could tell sort of various legends and stuff. You thought, you know, that
I'll tell you one really interesting story about it is that they were having trouble figure out how God's voice should be portrayed. Should it be a man's voice, a woman's voice, an old person's voice? But, you know, none of us have heard God speak literally. So they didn't know what to do. And they finally decided that one of the actors would be the actor who played Moses would actually speak God's voice. Because it was Moses hearing it in his own head. So that would be the way that they solved that. But, you know, they admitted at the beginning that there was a lot of freedom taken in interpreting the story, and it shouldn't be taken literally, the film. They tried to be as close to historical as possible. They asked me a lot of questions about the kind of music Miriam would have made and what instruments, and so on. But it was fun to work on that.
Oh, very cool. Hey, I mean, if I'm being honest, I'd rather watch that than the Ten Commandments any day. So
any day.
Well, thank you so much. I think you've put together some really compelling ideas about, you know, how this story might have originated and why it stuck around. So clearly, we are still celebrating it today. Happy Passover again to our listeners. Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Helen. And we will see all of you next time on Biblical Time Machine. Bye.
Bye.
Hey everyone, just wanted to remind you one more time about the Time Travelers Club. Remember, we do not have any advertising on this podcast, and that means we really need your support to keep it going. So if you like what you heard today, if you like what you hear every week, then please go to the link in the show description below for the Time Travelers Club. Subscribe, support us, and we appreciate every one of you. Thanks again. See you next time.